Welcome to the finale, the 16th session of our joint study of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik's Lonely Man of Faith. There he is, Rabbi Soloveitchik, the lonely man. Lonely not only because, as he described last week in the 19th chapter, because he embodies Adam the Second, but lonely in the more contemporary sense that he described, in the sense that the religious man of faith in the modern world, and again, he was writing in the 60s, although in many ways it's still true for us now, 45 years plus later, lonely because even the religious experience in the modern world is one that's been secularized. Sounds ironic, but if you read through the 9th chapter, you'll have a sense of what he's talking about. He makes this point that it's not an argument against atheism. It's an argument against the way contemporary religion is playing itself out. Not just Judaism, but contemporary religion in the modern world, it has been largely secularized. It's been adapted for the purposes. It's been adapted for the purposes of pragmatic goals, this-worldly goals. The idea that religion will solve all your problems. We've discussed this at different points throughout our analysis of the essay, and of course, I remind you of our earliest session where we looked at the lengthy fourth footnote from the Halachic Man, which is a very important parallel text to this notion of the state of contemporary religion. And because of that, all men of faith, all men of true faith, will be lonely and isolated. Now, in the 10th chapter, he really a very brief, short, three and a half, four pages, kind of coda, a kind of little homiletic encapsulation that he adds. I mean, if these last four pages had been left out of the essay itself might have well stood on its own. For whatever reason, he felt necessary to add this drasha, this homily at the end. I'll point out also, by the way, this edition that we've been using, which is the one that's freely available online through the website of Tradition, the publication in which the essay was originally appeared, the division into chapters is, in the different editions of the essay, the division into chapters was not kept universal. So I should just mention, certainly for those of you that at some point in the future may be listening in to the recorded archives of this series, the edition that we were using is that which appears on the website of the journal Tradition. You can get that at the website www.traditiononline.org, and from their homepage, from the archives link on the homepage of that journal, you can access freely both this essay, Lonely Man of Faith, as well as a number of other Rabbi Soloveitchik's essays, some of which I hope that we'll be studying together next semester of Web Yeshiva when we continue after the Hanukkah break and at some point in the beginning of January. But in this slot, at this time, the study of Rabbi Soloveitchik will continue with some of his other essays. So in the edition that we've been using, which is the Doubleday edition, Doubleday put out a paperback edition of Lonely Man of Faith, And that's the version that we've been using. So the chapter divisions are according to that version. In this newest edition that was put out by the OU Press together with Magid and Korain Publishers, I mentioned this last week, the week before, that there's a new edition which has some additional footnoting and reference work and a brief introductory essay. I mentioned that in that edition, they restore the original chapter divisions of the essay. So depending upon which edition you're using, the chapters that I've been referring to may not exactly match up. But here we are in the last chapter, chapter 10, and it's this exposition on the initial encounter between Eliyahu Hanavi and Elisha, Elijah the prophet and his great student and successor as the spiritual head and prophetic head of the Jewish people, the prophet Elisha. It's the first time that reading in Malachim Aleph, in the Book of Kings, the first Book of Kings, chapter 19, we encounter the person of Elisha. Elisha is busy plowing his field. He's got 12 yoke of oxen before him. Eliyahu passes by, casts his mantle upon him, which is a sign, a symbol of the teaching, of the engagement between master and disciple, between teacher and student. Elisha leaves the oxen behind. He runs after Eliyahu, and he says, "Let me kiss my father and mother, and then I'll follow you." He wants to become a devotee of the great prophet of Eliyahu, the great man of faith, Eliyahu. He turned from him, he took a yoke of oxen, he slaughters them, he cooks them with their instruments, he takes the plow itself and uses it to start the fire with which he boils up these oxen for a feast, for a meal. He gives it to the people and they eat. And then he rises up and goes after Eliyahu and becomes his faithful disciple, and ultimately will become his heir, his spiritual heir, his successor as the chief prophet in Israel. From this short biblical passage, the first time we meet Elisha, Rabbi Soloveitchik fills in between the lines. Elisha was a typical representative of the majestic community. Elisha is Adam the First, or he starts off as Adam the First. He's the son of a prosperous farmer, a man of property, he's got all these oxen after all, whose interests were centered around this worldly material goods, such as crops, livestock, market prices. His objective was economic success, his aspiration, material wealth. The Bible portrays him as efficient, capable, practical, remorseful of a modern business executive. Right? In other words, there he is. There's Elisha. He's the CFO of Morgan Stanley before the fall. When Eliyahu met him, we are told, he was supervising the work done by the slaves. He was with the 12th yoke in order not to lose sight of the slave laborers. What did this man of majesty have in common with Eliyahu Hanavi, the solitary covenantal prophet, the champion of God, the adversary of kings who walked as a stranger through the bustling cities of the Shomron, past royal pomp and grandeur, negating the worth of all goods to which his contemporaries were committed, reproaching sinners, preaching the law of God, and pretending his wrath. Eliyahu Hanavi, he's the classic Adam the Second. Hold on one moment, please. The classic Adam II comes along And the CFO leaves everything to go off and follow him. What bond could exist between a complacent farmer who enjoyed his homestead and the man in the hairy dress who came from nowhere, who finally disappeared under a veil of mystery? Yet unexpectedly, the call came through to this unimaginative, self-centered farmer. Now, this is, again, to be clear, the Rav is filling in midrashically a backstory here about Elisha. Suddenly, the mantle of Eliyahu was cast upon him. While he was engaged in the most ordinary, everyday activity, in tilling the soil, he encountered God and felt the transforming touch of God's hand. The strangest metamorphosis occurred. Within seconds, the old Elisha disappeared, and a new Elisha emerged. He goes through this conversion experience. Majestic man was replaced by covenantal man. Adam the first had become Adam the second. Through the intermediary of this encounter with Eliyahu, with another Adam the second. Now, there's a really important point here that the Rav doesn't, I don't know why, he doesn't take the bait. He doesn't feel it's necessary to expand here. But the question of, and again, he's returned full circle back to the dichotomies, back to the typologies of Adam the first and Adam the second, after having admitted earlier that we are all Adam the first, we are all Adam the second. These aren't two distinct characters. There are different aspects of each and every one of us, of each and every one of our personalities, and part of the problem is that we let them get disconnected, and part of the problem is that there's a misbalance in the contemporary world. But here he's gone back to describing them as individual characters. The question of, and last time we discussed at some length, the obligation that Adam the second has to Adam the first, and the obligation that Adam the first has to Adam the second, what each contributes to the other, how each needs the other. The idea here that an encounter between Adam the first and Adam the second can be transformative for Adam the first, that majestic man concerned with the search for dignity, concerned with this worldly, can be transformed into an Adam the second. And that says something about, you know, like the old, I'm sure I've used this metaphor before, the Bugs Bunny cartoons where, you know, you have the angel and the devil sitting on your shoulder fighting it out. Not to compare Adam the first to the devil. We've been very careful to say Adam the first is not a bad guy. But the spiritual power and force of the Adam the seconds, of the covenantal men and women amongst us and within us, to influence and to have an ennobling effect on Adam the first amongst us and within us is imperative. That's part of the task of Adam the second. The irony that the lonely man he can't be the Robinson Crusoe because he has an obligation to maintaining that covenantal community and also to inviting others in to join that covenantal community. Again, Rabbi Soloveitchik does not make that point here. It's a point, I think, that begs to be made, and it emanates from the description, you know, at least through the midrashicizing of the Eliyahu and Elisha story, of what happens. I don't know. Sherry asks, do you think one way to look at this is that Adam the first becomes aware of or embraces the soul that was breathed into him by God, and that that's the catalyst to becoming Adam the second? Well, I'm not sure. In other words, Adam the second. Here, go back to the psukim. It's it's Adam II who has, you know, the breath breathed into him. Adam I is created with Tzelem Elohim. So I'm not sure that Adam I can remember the experience of Adam II in order to be transformed into Adam II. Adam I, the majestic man, is created in God's holy image and is passed the Kipshuha. So it must be something else. The encounter with his alter ego, which makes him reconsider the his life, who he is, what he's doing, etc. Within seconds, the old Elisha disappeared and a new Elisha emerged. Majestic man was replaced by covenantal man. Adam I was replaced by Adam II. He was initiated into a new spiritual universe in which clumsy social class distinctions of little meaning, wealth played no role, serene, illuminated, universal we consciousness supplanted the small, limited, and selfish I consciousness. Old concerns changed, past commitments vanished, cherished hopes faded, and a new vision of a redemptive, covenantal reality in commensurate with the old vision of an enjoyable, majestic reality beckoned to him. Now, I'm not sure, but it's possible that the framing of this mashal, in this socioeconomic language, Elisha was this wealthy, landed gentry, oxes and slaves and farmland and etc. And he leaves it all behind to follow the wandering Eliyahu on his spiritual quest. Again, Adam I is not only a man of finance. You don't need to be rich to be in Adam I. Although, as my grandmother used to say, it doesn't hurt. The point is, it's part of the dominance. It can be part of the dominance, but not only. In other words, it's not inherent in the personality. It's not inherent. It's not an inherent trait in Adam I to be wealthy. But I think that part of what's motivating, the mashal, the metaphor here, is again a critique of mid-century. Mid-century religion, mid-century suburban Jewish religion, Jews, second generation, third generation immigrants who had made it, who had been to the universities and were in a different socioeconomic cut than the previous generations, and with that came a turning away from religion, or certainly the religion of the faith of Adam II. Could be that's part of what's going on here. No more did the farmer care for the oxen, the means of making the soil yield its abundance, which were so precious to him a while ago. He was no longer concerned with things so dear before. He slays the oxen, feeds the meat to the slaves, half-starved, tilled the soil for him, to whom he let me into the outward treated with contempt. Moreover, covenantal man renounced his family relationships. He bade farewell to father and mother and departed from their home for good. Like his master, like Eliyahu, he became homeless. Like his ancestor Yaakov, he became an Arami Oved, a straying Aramean, who took defeat and humiliation with charity and gratitude. Arav Elisha's withdrawal from majesty was not final. He followed the dialectical course of all of our prophets. He didn't cease being in Adam I. He also became in Adam II, and he was able to live with a unified dialectic personality, a personality which could encompass both majesty and covenant. And, the Rav says, that's the mark of all of the prophets. That's the mark of all of our great religious spiritual leaders. Later, when he achieved the pinnacle of faith and arrived at the outer boundaries of human commitment, he came back to society as a participant in state affairs, as an advisor of kings and teacher of the majestic community. Remember when Eliyahu ascends to heaven in his fiery chariot, his cloak falls back onto Elisha, and Elisha is requests at least a double portion of prophecy. And then he goes and he becomes the leader. Because remember, the Navi, the role of the Navi, the prophet, is not only to sit and think thoughts and to be a man of the spirit, but there was also a component of a type of political leadership. The Navi was always engaged with the kings, the Malchei Yisrael and the Malchei Yehuda, trying to lead, trying to goad, trying to point out foibles, trying to be the gadfly, trying to raise the people up, trying to knock the wicked down, trying to repair society. And you have to be engaged in the world. You have to be engaged in the majestic community, the natural work community, the pragmatic community, the world in which things happen, in which fields have to be planted, in which crops have to be sown, in which buildings have to be built, and ditches have to be built. But not only. Those of you that were online earlier in the week when we were having our discussion, La'avdil, in a very, very different context, but our discussion from the Agnon House about Yaakov, were you online for that session? I don't recall. Well, the discussion of modern Zionism and the tensions within modern Zionism as being mystical, miraculous, spiritual, heightened dream, agadic realm, and the very mundane, practical, this-worldly realm, and the tension of these two sides of the dialectic breaking apart and not being in communication with each other. And that's the source of struggle and pain and some of the problems in contemporary Zionism, and the attempt to try to reground them so that heaven and earth are reconnected was a theme that Adnan was very much engaged with in all of his writings about the return to the land and the establishment of Jewish society and sovereignty here. So again, Lahavdil here, the prophet also has to be engaged with both heaven and earth. He has to be engaged with the covenantal community and the majestic community. God ordered him to return to the people, to offer them a share in the covenantal drama, and to involve them in the great and solemn colloquy. He was God's messenger, carrying, like Moses, two tablets of stone containing the covenantal kerygma, the besorah, the religious message to the people. In the past, I'm sure I've mentioned the Rambam's important and well-known comment in the first book, 15th chapter, book 1, chapter 15 of the Mor Nebuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed. It's available in translation or in Hebrew translation, in English translation online. You can easily find it on the Wikisource or with Google, you'll find it. Guide 1:15. The discussion of Jacob's ladder, the Sulam, of the vision of the angels Olim v'Yordimba, asks some questions. What does it mean the angels ascend and descend? Angels start off in heaven, right? That's their starting point. They come down here to do their job, and then they return to heaven. So the Rambam wants to know, why is the wording reversed there? Olim v'yordim, they go up and then they come back down. And the Rambam makes a point which may be having some resonance with the metaphor of the cave in Plato's Republic. I've spoken about that in different contexts on Web Yeshiva. If you're unfamiliar with the cave metaphor from Plato's Republic, again, a quick Google, you'll find you know, movie versions of it on YouTube or plenty of other information that you need. And to compare the two ideas, but the idea that when one ascends the ladder of spiritual striving, when one ascends the ladder of knowledge of God, it's not something that you may dare keep unto yourself. That all spiritual achievements carry with it an obligation to descend and share that knowledge, share that wealth, bring other people along. And that's the experience that Elisha has. But many a time he felt disenchanted and frustrated because his words were scornfully rejected. And here you don't need to be Sigmund Freud to think that maybe the rub is speaking partially about himself. That his achievements as the lonely man of faith, trying to come back down that ladder and engage a religious community in America in mid-century, many a time he felt disenchanted and frustrated because his words were scornfully rejected. Or even worse, his words were woefully misunderstood. That's my addition to the sentence here, not the Rub's. However, Elisha never despaired or resigned. Despair and resignation were unknown to the men of the covenant who found triumph in defeat, hope in failure, who could not conceal God's word that was, to paraphrase Yirmiyahu, deeply implanted in his bones and burning in his heart like an all-consuming fire. Elisha was indeed lonely, but in his loneliness he met the lonely one. He met God. That's what happens to the lonely man of faith. You realize that there's another who is hold on a second. There is another who is just as lonely in the sense of unique, lonely in the sense of isolated, and that's God himself. And if God himself can join the community, if God can be in colloquy, in discussion, in conversation with me and the other men of faith and the other members of our covenantal community, well, then that gives me the strength and that gives me the model and that gives me the imperative to similarly try to make my way out. Elisha was indeed lonely, but in his loneliness he met the lonely one and discovered the singular covenantal confrontation of solitary man and God who abides in the recesses of transcendent solitude. Is modern man of faith entitled to a more privileged position and a less exacting and sacrificial role? Let's repeat that ending question again. Is modern man of faith entitled to a more privileged position and a less exacting and sacrificial role? If we aspire to be modern men, women, people of faith, we're entitled to a privileged position, a demanding and sacrificial role. We have to sacrifice. We are challenged. We have to strive to get up that ladder, and when we do, we always have to know we have to keep coming back down to engage in this community, both within our own community and within the larger majestic community. And it demands sacrifice. It's not easy. Remember, it's a mistake to think that the religious life is still waters and green paths and everything being happy and answers to all our questions. On the contrary, it's very demanding, it's very challenging. That's why it's so unpopular in the modern world, and in this sense it's only gotten worse than it was in the 1960s. The idea of everything wanting to be easy and fun and fast and mindless, completely intellectually sapped, coasting on neutral engagement with the world. You there? Is everyone there? Can you hear me? Okay. Where did it cut off? So with this ends the Lonely Man of Faith, with the privilege and the sacrifice. If we attempt to be spiritually engaged people in the modern world, if we if we, I'm not sure exactly, apparently there was a freeze on the system for a moment. I'm not sure exactly how much was missed. You could go back and catch the recording if it was too much. If we are meant to be spiritually engaged, striving for the life of Adam II, striving for the covenantal community, but yet still fully committed and rooted in this world, the majestic community, natural work community, we're going to feel that tension. Now that dialectic was something that Rabbi Soloveitchik himself felt very strongly. And that tension is something that motivates the entire work and much of his other religious philosophical writings, which I hope that we'll see in the next in the next semester. The need for Adam II, for the Lonely Man of Faith, to lead, to guide, to inform the work of Adam I and the community of Adam I is in some ways a critique of the critique of contemporary religious life. It's a critique of the modern Orthodox community with which Rabbi Soloveitchik himself was so closely identified, but with which he maintained an ongoing struggle and critique, because Adam II wasn't always engaged with Adam I, and Adam I was not always looking for the guidance of Adam II. And that breakdown and that disconnect is the source of the failings of the religious community. And that's part of the colloquial loneliness, not the existential loneliness that's described throughout the whole book, but the contemporary loneliness, the more garden variety loneliness of being an Adam II, being a lonely man of faith, and realizing that people aren't living up to the task. And that's a great challenge. And it's part of the ongoing, almost a half century later, it's part of the ongoing relevance of this group essay for the religious world. Now, I've mentioned a few times that the essay is written in a very universalistic tone. And indeed, its original iterations were delivered in front of non-Jewish audiences. And that's why that explains some of the sources on which he draws in order to build the work. It's not so much coming out of, at least on the explicit plane, Talmudic and halachic sources, and it's much more this ongoing homily on the Old Testament sources that the audience would have known and been familiar with. But in the end, it's a deeply strong analysis of the ideals of what modern Orthodoxy is and should be and would like to be, and a critique on the failings of modern Orthodoxy, both as he saw it in the 1960s and, if I can be so bold, even some of the failings and areas that still need improvement today. So that's one of the interesting paradoxes of the work. It's this very universalistic piece, which doesn't purport to be speaking about specifically the Jewish or specifically the Orthodox world, but in the end, it might, because of the pen of the author who's writing it, because of the author who's holding the pen, it comes back to be something with a particularly cogent and a particularistic point and message back to his own community, back to the community of which he was the undisputed head. So that concludes our reading. We did a very close reading. Kol HaKavod to all of you that have been following along live and speaking out into the future. To anyone that will have gotten this far in the archives, I welcome your feedback, your questions. For those of you that will be following along in the archives, be happy to hear from you at some point in the future. My email is Jeffrey Sachs, JeffreySachs at gmail.com. I assume that will be an email that will be active for many years to come, unless Google goes under. So if and when you shall be hearing this message, I feel like those people that sent that recorded message out to space on one of the Voyager missions. Who knows, we'll be listening to this years hence. I look forward to hearing how the essay resonated with you and with your own experiences and with your own struggles and your own triumphs in spiritual life as men and women of faith. So thank you all. I'll stay online if anybody has any questions. And I look forward to continuing learning Rabbi Soloveitchik with you. If you're interested between now and when the new semester resumes, so look at those essays, in the spring 1978 issue of Tradition, which is available from the archives page of traditiononline.org. At spring 1978, they ran a special issue with 5 essays by Rabbi Soloveitchik. Almost all of them, at least 3 of them, I touched on as we moved along through the Lonely Men of Faith, because they contain important parallel sources to what we did. Those are the essays Majesty and Humility, Catharsis, and Redemption Prayer Talmud Torah. There are 2 other important essays there in that collection as well. In the spring 1978 volume of Tradition, I'm putting the direct link to it up in the chat right now. You can download those PDFs and get a head start by reading through some of those. You should start with those essays that I mentioned redemption prayer, Talmud Torah, catharsis, and majesty and humility. I think that in the coming semester, those will be the things that we'll be looking at probably most closely. So thank you all very much for making it a rewarding experience of teaching and learning, and I hope we'll have an opportunity to meet again and learn together in the future.